Hey there, everybody. It is that time again from KQED Public Radio. This is Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. And today on The Breakdown, she learned about social justice and injustice growing up in the Deep South, where she studied at Jackson State University and learned about civil rights organizing, among other things.
And in fact, it helped launch her career as a highly regarded labor leader. And her relatively new position now is a political consultant helping to steer Kamala Harris's presidential campaign. We're excited to have LaFonza Butler here in the house. But first, Marisa, we got some stuff to go through.
We got to talk about Gavin.
Our gallivanting Governor Gavin
Newsom.
Look
at that alliteration.
Okay? There we go. He was in El Salvador having pupusa, I think, and talking with folks down there, trying to understand the migrant situation.
I hope he had pupusas.
He did,
okay,
I believe.
Good.
Somebody tweeted it. Down there for 4 days, first trip overseas. Well, I guess not overseas,
out
of country, out of the borders. Heard about life down there. And, you know, there was some criticism that, you know, why didn't he go to Mexico? Why didn't he go to Mexico first? You know, like Jerry did. But he did go to Mexico, actually, in November. But, you know, I think one thing about this governor, and you can certainly criticize, things that he has done so far, but he learns by seeing things and by seeing things in person. And, you know, you've seen that throughout, you know, the first few months where he'd go somewhere to see things. I think that's, you know, partly a part of his dyslexia. He likes to actually, rather than read about something, he likes to experience it. And, he came back and, back in Sacramento now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the criticisms are twofold. One is this just sort of like, you know, sticking it to Trump, doing this for political reasons? And the other is that we do have a lot of really pressing problems here in California that he obviously needs to help tackle. And I think more broadly, and we talked about this with his chief of staff, the question of like, where is this administration focused? What are their priorities? You know, and I think that it's early yet, so it's not entirely fair to say, like to judge how they've been doing on a lot of those questions. But
yeah, but I think the other piece of it, though, too, is did you really have to go down to El Salvador to know why people want to get out of there? I mean, it's pretty well known. It's drug violence and lack of jobs and opportunity, but really fear for their lives. So I think that was part of the criticism.
To me,
that's
like the least sort of interesting criticism, right? Because obviously,
sure, my criticism is the least interesting one.
No, but just because obviously it's always different when you see something firsthand and talk to people.
Absolutely.
We know that as journalists, right?
Yeah,
otherwise, we would
true.
Just sit behind our desks all day and call people, which we do.
We did
some
that
of.
Today.
Speak for yourself.
But there was, you know, we were talking about how people are feeling about the new governor. There was a new poll out this week from Quinnipiac. That's how you say it, Quinnipiac.
You can say it. I'll stick with Pete Buttigieg. That's my like win of the year.
Yeah, and his approval rating in that poll, and you know, polls are momentary, fleeting things, but 40% approval, 33%. So on the upside, but not a huge approval rating for someone who's relatively new.
He's doing better among Democrats than
Republicans. Yeah, it's like 7% approval among Republicans. But the interesting thing is independent voters in that poll, no party preference voters, 31% approval versus 41% disapproval. You know, we were talking earlier, maybe the independent voters, there could be more of them who are former Republicans, you know, leaving the party because of the current president. We don't know that.
Everyone we get on the show who we think's a Republican, like our guest last week. Oh, no, I re-registered.
Yeah, not anymore. Yeah, Amory Schubert. And then there's also, I guess, I don't know if it's good news for him, but his move on the death penalty, that was also asked in the poll. The reprieve that he gave, the temporary halt to executions, kind of split right down the middle. I think it was like 46, 47.
Yeah, but interestingly, just like another poll we saw recently, more voters did say that they oppose the death penalty, prefer life in prison than do. So I think, you know, from his perspective, probably, and we've talked to people around him about this, you know, he has made a sort of political habit of going out and sort of sticking his neck out on issues where he might be a little ahead of the electorate. And I think they would point to this to say, well, look, people are kind of moving in this direction. You know, again, he's not on the ballot anytime soon. So he kind of has some ability to do those sorts of things.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, these types of polls, I mean, approval ratings are never or rarely, you know, over 50% in the high 60s. I mean, if you see Jerry Brown, I think he had one little honeymoon phase where everybody really loved him. Mostly because they hated the legislature so much, which is the other thing about these things. But yeah, you know, I think something for him to watch and definitely.
Interesting, though, you know, we talked to Anne-Marie Schubert, the DA of Sacramento, last week. And then this week, in spite of all this stuff we were just talking about, they're going to seek the death penalty on the Golden State Killer. So
not surprising.
Not surprising. But, you know, I think you will continue to see the number of death sentences go down, you know, as that's been happening for a long time. I think what Newsom did will probably accelerate that. Another big story this week and still very much unfolding, Marisa, one you've been on top of, along with Lisa Pickoff White here at KQED and Suki Lewis, I guess we should say. PG&E, the question of its solvency, it's in bankruptcy. Study came out this week looking at what would happen if sort of the status quo, if things don't change, if there isn't reform. Study by a UC Berkeley energy expert showing that electricity rates could skyrocket about 50% overnight. What did you make? That was actually a report that was requested by the Newsom administration.
And so I make that was politics. I mean, it's not untrue. And as somebody who's been covering this, probably too far in the weeds, Scott might argue.
There's a dandelion in your ear.
Yeah, exactly. It's not surprising. I mean, you know, as much as there's not a lot of love lost for PG&E right now in their service area or in Sacramento, the truth is that these devastating wildfires, the sort of lingering questions over how much utilities will have to pay for the damages, has really hurt their standing on Wall Street. And unfortunately for us ratepayers, like when, you know, the bond ratings agencies say these guys are junk status, that means the borrowing costs go up. And who pays for that? We do.
Yeah. So, well, and it's also worth remembering, as I'm sure everyone in Sacramento does, that, you know, electricity, like, or utilities generally, like healthcare, affects everyone. And we saw what happened with the brownouts and back in the early 2000s led to Gray Davis getting recalled, part of the reason why. So, you know, these are big issues that you want to get right. And sometimes it's hard to do that.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, this week is going to be a sort of interesting turning point for Newsom. On Friday, he's expected to announce the sort of outcome of the 60-day strike team he tasked with coming up with the report. I'm hearing that it will not come with any sort of concrete recommendations from the governor's office, which I think lawmakers were looking for, but rather will sort of lay out the problem and possible solutions. Which from a political standpoint is kind of interesting. It's a little squishy. It's not the governor taking leadership and saying these are the steps we need to take. On the other hand, this is a tough issue, as we've alluded to, and not just around the utility question and who pays for it, but also around questions of local control and prevention and environmental review.
And this is a complicated issue, and it's probably best to have some hearings and some, you know, talk about it rather than saying, I want to do this. Let's learn as much as we can before we make a final decision. All right. One last thing quickly on the Quinnipiac poll. There was also a question about presidential politics. Joe Biden, despite his, you know, criticisms about his invading people's space, was at 26% in California, followed by Bernie Sanders at 18% and right behind with Kamala Harris at 17%. We're going to talk to our guest about that race in just a moment. So we're going to take a short break right now. And when we come back, our conversation with labor leader turned political consultant LaFonza Butler. Listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos, and we're thrilled to have with us today a woman who until recently was a top labor leader in California. LaFonza Butler is now a partner at the high-profile consulting firm that's running Kamala Harris's presidential campaign. LaFonza Butler, thank you so much for coming in. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And for sitting here listening to us.
It's awesome.
Listen to us, Gab.
It's great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So tell us, first of all, like, what are you doing with Kamala Harris? What's your role in the campaign?
Well, my title is senior strategist, senior advisor, and so I advise. I strategize.
What was your advice today?
Yeah, what kind of advice are you offering?
Work really, really hard. Spend a lot of time with folks in Iowa. Get to know them, their issues, and their pets. It's National Pet Day, so she spent a lot of time talking with Iowa voters today and headed back to D.C. So,
oh my God, there's like a day for everything. Let's just say that, right? Like it was National Sibling Day this weekend. Anyway, Well, you know, this is, as you know, a very crowded field and only getting more crowded by the moment. What are you guys, like, focusing on? I know she's in Iowa, but it seems like sort of the common wisdom is that her path lies through South Carolina, you know, like, and California is her home state. Like, what, how do you balance all those things at this stage in the campaign?
I think, you know, what she has sort of laid out for the campaign really is a set of values, a value set for the country. It is clear in sort of how she introduced herself at the launch in Oakland, talking about building a campaign for the people. Laying out that set of values, building a team that represents the best of the political talent in the country, but also the best of what we have to offer in representing her value set. And then moving. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Oh, just the for the people thing, right? Mm-hmm. So this is her campaign slogan. She was a former prosecutor. So you walk into court, say for the people. Was that her idea? Like, who came up with that?
I think it was a mishmash of different people, honestly. But it was,
I think it's really smart.
But I got to give my partner, Sean Clegg, a lot of our creative credit. But a lot of the...
So Sean came up with it. No, I'm going to get LaFonza in trouble.
One thing you and Kamala Harris have in common is she went to Howard University, you went to Jackson State, both part of the historically black colleges and university systems. Have you, when you talk about your experiences at those schools, like what do you talk about? What kind of bond is there, you know, because of that experience?
So for me, and I think that the senator would say the same, for me, it was just the richness of what the university had to offer. It was, yes, predominantly black students steeped in a really, really deep culture of civil rights. So I had the opportunity to have professors who were SNCC organizers, who had spent Freedom Summer in jail in Macomb, Mississippi. I had the opportunity to be a part of the Fannie Lou Hamer Law Society. And so it really did frame how I thought about social justice and was the beginning of my socialization for what I would do and could do with the rest of my life. And I think that the senator experienced a similar similar environment at Howard, and it's an incredibly life-changing and very influential experience.
She went to Howard from California. You went to Jackson State from Mississippi, where you grew up. You know, what was any thoughts about the differences there about going to school in your home state versus coming across
country?
Yeah, because
it's just a couple hours from where you grew up, right?
It's about an hour and a half from where I grew up. And look, you know, California is America's melting pot. And to go from, I couldn't imagine what it was like for her going from America's melting pot to Chocolate City in Washington, D.C. But I know for me, again, sort of being enveloped in that kind of culture, helping me to understand where my ancestry came from and what it was like really for those professors to fight and you know, dare I say, lay down their lives for my own freedom was incredibly influential to the choices that I made.
Did you get to know John Lewis there?
I didn't. I got to know folks
a couple
like,
years between you guys. Like,
well, as a teacher, no, not as a student, as a teacher.
I got to know some of the lesser known folks in the civil rights movement. The chair of my department, political science department, was a woman named Mary D. Coleman. She was a lawyer, and she worked on the Ayers case, which was a big deal for historically black colleges and federal funding and equalizing the funding for historically black colleges. And so that's the kind of sort of lesser known names that really had an incredible impact.
So we just mentioned you grew up in Magnolia, Mississippi, mm-hmm. right? So a pretty tiny place, I believe.
How do you say it down there?
Magnolia.
Is that
Magnolia.
How you say it? Oh, okay. I thought there was going to be like a big brawl there.
No. There's no twang to Magnolia.
Really? Okay. My bad.
So you're the youngest of three kids. I mean, what was your childhood like? And it sounds like you had somewhat of a political awakening in college, but I'm curious if that was something that was part of kind of your family life growing up too at all.
You know, it wasn't. My family was pretty basic. My mom worked really hard. My dad died when I was 16 years old. He had heart disease. By the time he passed away, he'd had six heart attacks. He had a stroke. He had a heart transplant. Got a new heart from an 18-year-old who died in a motorcycle accident. Mm. So my life was really lived through the eyes of a caregiver. Mm. My mother was my father's caregiver in the last years of his life, and having to understand what families every day go through when it comes to issues like of healthcare.
Well, and seeing your mom as a caregiver, and you know, you went on later in life to work for the union, SEIU, which has in-home care providers and nursing home workers. I mean, was that an inspiration for you?
Look, my mother's story really was the precursor to my professional career. Not only did she work as a in-home caregiver for my father, she worked the 11-to-7 shift at a nursing home as a CNA. She also worked as an armed security guard when we lived in New Orleans at some of the most dangerous projects in the city. And she is an incredible woman who just showed me the strength of what it took to put your family on your back and do everything you can to make more opportunities for your kids. And so did it inspire me to work for SEIU? Sort of. I would say it inspired me to think about how my life was bigger than my own.
Growing up, it sounds like obviously your family was working class. Did you feel poor? Like, was that something you were aware of as a kid?
I wasn't. You know, I felt so richly loved and poured into. Mm-hmm. I had teachers who cared about me. I had neighbors who looked after me. I had, you know, every friends, you know, that we just sort of shared stories. So I didn't. Yes, we were, you know, in hindsight now, I realize we were poor, right?
Thing,
and
though,
so, but
yeah.
But no, I always felt like I knew where my next meal was going to come from. Mm-hmm. Did it mean that my mom was on food stamps sometimes? Absolutely. So I know what those choices are like for working moms. And I think some of that stuff is what really inspired me to continue to work so hard for the women that I worked for at SEIU.
Just a reminder, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. Our guest today is political consultant LaFonza Butler. And before the show started, we were chatting, and because we kind of glossed over, you were a labor leader, you were the president of SEIU, and now you're a political consultant. And while we were chatting, you said you went from, I asked you what the difference was, and you said, well, you went from a position of authority to a position of influence. What did you mean by that?
Look, there are 360,000 working women and men in the state of California who are caregivers who trusted me with their dues money, with their resources, with the political capital that they had earned in their fight for social and economic justice. And they gave me the opportunity to be a voice of authority on their behalf on issues that they felt like needed to be addressed in their lives, in the lives of their families and communities. And going from a place where you are the decision maker in partnership with the member leaders and the staff team to actually being in a position where you have to use the influence of the principal for whom you work,
right,
to get things done. And you have to think differently about how you build consensus across the organization or the campaign to make sure that the values of the candidate are being lived out up and down the organization. It really is more about the sort of soft skills of influence.
Managing
that
Well, do you, but I mean, I've always thought, like, as somebody, as a journalist who, you know, my life's work is like asking hard questions to people in power. You were on the outside for a long time, pushing people in power to do things. Like, is it hard sometimes? Do you ever worry about like running your mouth or pushing back too hard, or is it?
You know, it is. It's a challenge. I have to think more about it. Honestly, my relationship with Senator Harris started about 10 years ago when she was running for attorney general, and there are not a lot of labor unions in LA who were willing to endorse her because she was
running against
Steve Cooley. In LA,
and so it was,
and so we sort of came into each other's lives as peers, mm-hmm. And having to adjust has been an interesting adjustment. But I can't think of anyone anyone else that I would make that kind of a change for.
So you've been in this new position for since January.
Sure.
And I would imagine you went from a place, you know, being president of SEIU, which has a fair amount of structure, to a place where, I mean, campaigns are just crazy, right? I mean, it's only just beginning. You're laughing. So, like, what's the – how do you navigate that difference?
You draw a lot of boxes on the paper.
Just to make yourself feel better.
Just, like, to make myself believe that there is – that there's structure. No, look, Senator Harris, you know, she was the attorney general. She was the DA. She is a woman of structure and organization in a lot of ways. And so being able to sort of work with her incredible team that really has been put together. Juan Rodriguez, our campaign manager, has done a really, really good job recruiting the top talent across the country. But it's a struggle. It's a change. It's a shift. It is.
You got to be really nimble on your feet.
But it's so worth it. It is really, really worth it.
Well, I want to talk, though, a little bit more about your time at SEIU, because you really influenced, and most of our listeners would not have any idea of this, but some of the biggest sort of wins for not just labor, but I think you guys would say working people of the past decade. I know that, you know, you were really involved when Jerry Brown first got elected in the whole Prop 30 fight, which was basically labor had come forward with a millionaire's tax, a far more sort of expansive tax on wealthy people. And you were, I think, at the table cutting the deal to go with Jerry Brown's a little more regressive idea, which included sales tax and income tax hikes. And then also later on, when you guys wanted to go to the ballot to raise the minimum wage, you cut a deal with the governor to make sure that that came through the legislature. Can you just talk a little bit about, like, those sorts of negotiations? And, like, how do you walk into an office with someone like Jerry Brown?
There's no one like Jerry Brown.
Yeah, and open those conversations. Because you guys had a pretty big leverage over them, right? You're like, we're going to the ballot. We have all these members. We have this money.
In addition to the greatness of our governor, he also had a really good team. And so the intimidation for me was less going into a room and talking with Jerry Brown. It was more
the pre-conversations.
Going into the room and doing negotiations with Nancy McFadden.
Right. And Dana.
And Nancy McFadden taught me so much about, I mean, and we were often on opposite sides in a lot of our positions.
What'd she teach you?
She taught me the grace of leadership. Nancy never led from a place of haughtiness, but she always led from a place of humility. She always wanted to find places of common ground. She always put the people of California first. And so it just sort of kept me grounded in the fact that we were not enemies, that we were not, frankly, even on opposite sides. We had different opinions. Mm-hmm. But we had the same destination.
Do you think that, like, part of that with someone in that position, too, is that, like, for Nancy, I think, and, you know, I covered her for a long time, she wanted to do the best job she could do for her principal, right? And so, like, carrying that out is different than coming in with your sort of personal mission that you have going on in there. Like, I would assume that's helpful. And maybe you had a little of that, too, because you were speaking for all of your members, not just yourself.
That's what I mean by the common destination. We were both working for the people of California. She represented way more than I did. but we all came into rooms of tension and disagreement and negotiation with Californians in mind and the best of for Californians.
We had Senator Hallie Mitchell on a few weeks ago. And one of the things we talked with her about was she's obviously a big advocate for criminal justice reform and young people. And we asked her, like, were there times when you had to educate the governor about some of these issues because he didn't have any personal contact or wasn't something he was focused on? Did you feel that way with Jerry Brown in terms of labor issues working?
Governor Brown has done more in, like, the last 4 years than I've done in my entire 40. So there are not a lot of issues that he doesn't have a lot of experience with. My biggest point of education that I could remember with Governor Brown was really about the issue of home care. And talking with him about the importance of home care workers in our state and the services that they were providing. And the governor actually had an experience with a home care worker because his great aunt who was dying, had a caregiver and found her caregiver on Craigslist. And he was like, well, it can't be that hard, LaFonza.
You're like, well.
Well, it's like, well, for you, Governor, yeah, for right. your family.
unlimited resources.
Right. Well, it's difficult. It's more difficult for families who are having to play by the rules of Medicaid and having to sort of find their way. Right. So, you know, that was, I think, the biggest sort of opportunity that I found to educate Governor Brown. Mostly I was the one getting the education.
So we kind of skipped around a little bit, but on your personal life, you do have a 4-year-old daughter in
LA
and a partner.
I do.
And we talked about early coming out of the South, being African American. What was it like coming out like with your family? And I don't know, has that been something that you feel like has really informed your career?
No. It's an interesting question. No one's ever asked me that question. But I will say, in reflection, you know, my mother was not only my father's caregiver, but the saint of our family. It was never a question of acceptance for me, whether it was my mother or my two older brothers. Everything was really about how do we support one another to be the best that we can be, no matter what that is or what that looks like. And so while I have incredible empathy and have friends whose families have rejected them based on their sexuality, that was not my story and not my experience. And I'm so grateful for that. And it's also not my primary identity.
Mm-hmm.
Different than...
Right, it took us 28 minutes to get there.
Different than others. You know, I grew up in the South. And, you know, every Sunday I was at Sunday school and church. And I did vacation Bible study. And so... My life really was framed around the Golden Rule, and my mother really sort of made that an incredibly important part of how we saw not only ourselves but saw other people in our communities.
We have just a little bit less than a minute left, but we know, I believe, that you are turning 40 one month from today. Is that correct?
It is.
What does
that
mean to you to be, you know, about to exit your 30s?
I don't know. It's interesting. I came to California and I was 29 years old, was elected president of the second largest local in the country at 30. I left the SEIU after 18 years as I was 39. And I really feel like turning 40 is an opportunity to write a new story, to really create a different plot in my life story. And hopefully I send this message to other young folks that you don't have to be somewhere for 40 years doing the same thing.
People got that message.
Well,
you could end up in the White House.
Write a country story.
LaFonza Butler, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank
really
you so much for having me.
You bet. Well, that does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. It's a production of KQED Public Radio. For more of our politics coverage, you can subscribe to our podcast newsletter. It'll be delivered every Tuesday in your inbox.
That's right. You can find it at kqed.org/newsletters. Our producer is Guy Marzorati. Our engineer is Seal Muller. KQED's leadership team includes Holly Kernan, Ethan Lindsay, and Vinny Tong. I'm Marisa Lagos. Find me on Twitter at mlagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. You can find me on Twitter at Scott Schaefer. That is a wrap for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We'll see you next week from Los Angeles.